Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. As always, I really do appreciate it. But if you enjoy what you hear, if you enjoy listening to this podcast, I'd appreciate a review. Or even better yet, if you wanted to share it out on social media, maybe pick an episode that was one of your favorites, share it on social media, share it with a friend, with a family member you think might benefit from what we talk about here on the podcast. Today's episode, I really enjoy. And I know a lot of people are maybe going to, when they hear this, tune out, but I'd encourage you to really, really listen. If you're a cattle guy and you hear the word goats, I think it's not relevant to you. I'd encourage you to listen to it because it's a really good conversation about goat production and where it can fit in a farm and how it can do things that you can never do with cattle. You can eat things that cattle will never eat and generate really good revenue per animal unit per acre, or, you know, revenue on land that you maybe never were able to generate revenue on before. And so this conversation with Adam Ledvina of Iowa Kiko Goats is really good, really interesting to me. And I think there's a lot of good information. He walks through some of the numbers and the financials of his goat production enterprise as if it were a commercial operation. He's a seed stock producer, and so he's doing better yet, but he walks through them as if a commercial producer was doing this and really shows the financial potential, the income potential that these goats have to offer. So I'd encourage you to listen to it if that's something that you're even vaguely or remotely considering or think that it could potentially serve a purpose on your farm, whether you have woodlands that have a ton of overgrowth and brush that, you know, that your cattle will never eat and you're just not utilizing, or maybe you've got weeds out in noxious weeds in different pastures or rangelands that goats would enjoy that your cattle are not. You know, there's a lot of potential, but I really enjoyed this conversation and I hope that you do as well. And with that, we'll dive into my conversation with Adam Ledvina of Iowa Kiko Goats. Well, hey, Adam, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I'm trying to think now who it was and I forget, but I love guest recommendations and you were a guest recommendation. Somebody said, you got to get this guy on. He's doing some awesome stuff. And whenever I hear that, it's definitely something I got to check out because it's cool. There's people everywhere that are doing awesome things that a guy like me will never hear of unless I get a recommendation. And when I started checking out what you're doing, following you on some social medias, I saw pretty quickly you're doing some awesome stuff, and had someone not pointed me in your direction, I may never have come across you. So I'm glad they did. And I'm excited to dig into that a little bit more. But maybe if you wouldn't mind, before we dive into your history, which I want to get into, just share with the listeners a little bit about what you're doing today, what your operation looks like, and then we'll jump back into how you got into it.
Yeah, so operate here in Tama County, Central Iowa, and run about 500 head of Kiko Goats, operate Iowa Kiko Goats. And it's a large-scale holistic meat goat operation. We focus on low maintenance. We don't deworm anybody. We don't trim hooves. We don't give grain. Really just kind of raising goats how we wanted to raise goats in the beginning. And once you get into goats, you realize not all goats are the same, and some of them are quite a bit more work than others. And so we focused in on calling out the weak ones, calling out the ones that didn't fit our standards, which become higher and higher standards as you get going. Sure. And so that's pretty much what we do now, is raise something that we wanted to raise from the beginning and almost create a new sub-breed that requires nothing.
Yeah, oh, that's perfect. That's awesome. Cool. So we'll dive into more of that later. But were you in agriculture? Were you always in agriculture? Or what got you interested in it? And why did you go the route that you did?
No. So I wasn't raised on the farm. Both sets of grandparents' farm. So I was very much around it, but sure, I was not raised in it. So that kind of helped me with having the mindset, you know, not doing it how we always did it, because that's how we do it. Like, yeah, you know, my dad did it this way and he ingrained in me, I had to do it this way. I just kind of took what I saw. It skips a generation. And I actually lost both of my grandpas when I was a senior in high school. So I wasn't really around for them to teach me exactly what to do, which was good and bad. I mean, there's a lot of things I don't know that I would have known in that scenario, but also I didn't have to. I get some of their good habits, but not their bad habits type of deal.
What type of farms were there? Your grandparents?
So pretty conventional. I mean, cattle, hay, corn, soybeans. One of them was a dairy until like 94. So I don't hardly even remember that very well. It was there. And then others that had hogs. But I mean, that's when you still had outdoor lots. And I don't even know how many there were. I just remember those short memories of having hogs out there. And for the most part, corn, soybeans, hay, and beef cattle.
Sure. Okay, cool. Sorry, I kind of cut you off there. You were saying, you didn't have that kind of mindset locked in because you didn't necessarily grow up being too involved with the farm, but
sure. Well, and then I went to college for 4 years. I went to Central College in Pella, Iowa, and got a environmental science, biology, natural resource type degree. And so that kind of gave me a whole nother direction to look at. And it wasn't until after college that I decided to get into farming on the side of conservation and just kind of combine it all together with a very different mindset than you would expect.
No, that makes sense. Did you go right in? What did you do for work? Did you start right away doing your own thing, or were you?
Yes and no. I graduated college and I also studied abroad in Europe for a little bit. So that kind of helps throw a little different thinking into your head too.
Yeah.
But I worked for the DNR, for Iowa DNR for a while. I worked out in California. I worked down in Florida for different conservation. I worked down in the Everglades for the state fish and wildlife down there. And then out in around San Francisco Bay Area doing habitat land restoration work around Golden Gate Bridge and then up into Napa Valley and kind of all over in the mountains and whatnot. Wildfires out west and just, I don't know, you see a lot of different things that kind of changes your mindset and how you want to do things, like controlling fire with goats. And
Well, I think I mentioned that podcast I did a long time ago with some Star Creek Land Stewards, maybe, I think it was something like that in California, that they're kind of doing goat grazing for hire. And they talk about their primary job is not necessarily brush management, like maybe it is here clearing woods or something. It's fire prevention. And that's what they're doing it for. And I thought that was really interesting perspective on how there's a lot of people that see the value in that specifically for for fire prevention, which is interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's when I was traveling around. I mean, I had kind of a small goat herd started here right after college, but I was still traveling around, and everywhere I went, I would kind of like meet up with producers who are already doing it and try to kind of soak in that knowledge of somebody who's doing it rather than try to. I mean, you learn a lot from reading books. You learn a lot from seeing what your neighbor's doing. But if you're actually meeting somebody in person, having that one-on-one and learning from them that way, I think you gain a lot more.
Yeah.
And so I met up with people in California, Southern California, Northern California, who are running goats mostly for fire mitigation, but for same thing, the brush management. And they meet up with guys in Texas who are doing it on a large scale. And then down the southeast to have more of the parasite load to just kind of learn from all of them and just kind of focus in on looking around their farm, like, oh, what are they doing right? What are they doing wrong? Not that people are doing it wrong, but, you know, sort of.
What works, what doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you know while you were doing all this traveling, like goats was going to be a big part of your future and that you were intentionally looking at those types of operations?
No, it was a total accident. I mean, I remember in college I had a chemistry partner who had goats, and like we're supposed to be, you know, talking about chemistry, and they talking about goats, and like we just kind of, you know, that'd be interesting, and talk about like doing this just clearing out brush with goats, and it's like, oh, somebody should do that. I don't really know anybody locally who does it. It's like, well, I guess we'll do it then.
Perfect, that's awesome. I'm curious on the conservation side what your perspective was there. It seems like for a long time there was almost an idea in conservation, government conservation work, that animals and livestock needed to be separated from land in order to be able to conserve land appropriately. And maybe it's starting to turn. I'm curious, did you see that or experience that when you were working with government work, or would you say something different? Or
it's definitely starting to take a turn. I'd say just in the last year or two, the Iowa DNR has kind of taken a new focus on that and using them as a tool and inviting like renting out cattle on or leases on state ground. Down when I was working down in Florida, actually down in the Everglades, we had a contract. It was like about a 10 or 12,000 acre piece of ground that they had it was basically part of a farm. Like, they had a guy that had a bunch of Brahma cattle down there, and they just operated it. They rotated through, and like, it, I would say it wasn't as well maintained as far as like a lot of continuous grazing. It wasn't the best rotational, but it was a good start and like something to learn from. Also just very different. It's the Everglades and it's Brahmas, and like, you can't compare much of that, but just the management style, because we would do fire and run fire through the glades and kind of rotate cattle in the dry season, so they're not just standing in water. Just kind of taking a little bit of all of that, put it together.
I'm glad it seems to be coming around, because I mean, when you look at historically how land was developed, livestock or large ruminants, small ruminants were obviously a pretty big part of that. And so now when they talk about just completely removing animals in order to somehow protect or conserve land, it seems like.
Oh yeah. Well, and I worked here at the Meskwaki tribe with their buffalo program, and it was pretty much, they were on one half and they are the other half. We got a few more paddocks, paddocking things off, adding more acres, adding more animals, and just rotating through, managing the ground a little bit more. I mean, you can't really take buffalo and run them anywhere. You got to stay in your certain area, and you got to have your like a pretty strong electric fence, 8-10 foot tall.
No, and that's true. Partly, probably a lot of why those conservation decisions were made is because of the management that livestock, how the livestock were managed historically. And as you know, livestock on land alone is not a good thing necessarily. If managed poorly, it can be as or more destructive than completely removing them. But when good management is incorporated with that, it can be pretty advantageous. So that makes sense. So you had goats while you were doing all this traveling around. Were you started right off the bat trying to do a business of actual, like the goat clearing business from the start, or what was that?
Yeah,
what did that look like at the beginning?
So I had had, I was working for the DNR, and like at that time I had various different positions, but I mean, like you're a seasonal and you're working for Pheasants Forever. There's kind of a stair-step effect to working in the DNR, especially back then. Now, I mean, there's jobs everywhere now in every asset of life since COVID. But back then it was a lot more competitive. So you kind of started a pretty low rate, and you kind of got to do something on the side to get going. And I'm just seeing the need. So, I mean, I'm working for the DNR, and I'm in a $150,000 skid steer track loader with a Fecon head on it, and I'm brushing mulch, and you're in it all day long for the whole winter. And then we're spraying honeysuckle, spraying multifloro, spraying everything with herbicide. And then in the springtime, we're doing fire, and we're burning everything, which I love it. I'm still a firefighter. Like, I love doing fire, but it does have that danger factor, that risk factor associated with it. And I'm on our volunteer fire department here in Chelsea, and so we get calls all the time. I mean, there's sometimes we get 5 or 6 calls a week. Sometimes we get once a week. But I mean, in fire season, you're getting calls all the time from somebody who lit a fire or an accidental fire that happened. And it's, I mean, they can cause big problems. So when you can avoid, when you can change that, I still think fire on land is a good thing periodically, but if you can graze it and do something a little safer, that helps. So between the heavy impact of machinery, the Fecon heads on the brush mowers, the working in steep terrain with a brush cutter on your chest and swinging that blade around and walking up at 45 degree angles, and then the fire and the herbicide, just a lot of expense, health concerns, whether it's rolling an ankle on a steep slope in the Lus Hills or in Northeast Iowa, or herbicide usage, which is controversial, but I mean, it's there. Yeah. If you can avoid all that kind of stuff with, I don't know, raising small ruminants, raising goats that naturally want to do that. So I'm looking around at everything I'm doing thinking, you know, goats can do this. And it reminded me of that kind of that talk I had with my partner in school, and just, you know what, just need to get some goats. And some friends, like, I mean, I have these harebrained ideas and I say them out loud, and one of my friends like, why don't you just get some then? And found some pointing me towards a certain direction. I'm like, all right, I guess that'd be good. He's like, I don't think you're going to do it anymore. Let's just go together and get them, because I think this, you're talking about this a lot. You just need to do it. So we went and got them and started with 5 goats. And they were mixed breeds, bred into a boar buck, and quickly learned that boar goats are just their own thing with, I mean, they're kind of the flagship meat animal. They're what everyone talks about in the meat industry, but they're pretty high maintenance. They're pretty parasite susceptible. A lot of, like, when you're in anything the show industry, as you probably know, I mean, higher maintenance, they might not be the best mothers just because they look good. They look good body type, but when you start looking at the how well they raise an animal and how well do they actually work on the ground. So I'm taking boar goats and crossbreeds and putting them on brush chop, take them out on brush, and they're picking up parasites. You need to treat them all the time. You got them dying on you, and you just gotta spend all your time trying to save a life. And within a couple of years, I got to a Kiko buck, and I saw the hybrid vigor in all the kids. And then the next year, I just axed every. I got rid of all my other breeds. Just went full Kiko from close to the get go. Not exactly the get go.
So, well, yeah, there's a bunch there. First of all, I guess we'll get to the Kikos later because I'm intrigued by that. But the fact that you're doing all this work that seems like, and I hear you talk about all the stuff that now you know a goat can do and produce meat and generate value while doing it, and you're walking around with brush cutters and mulchers, and sounds like a total waste of resources, both in all like all resources, financial, labor, fuel, and
Risk.
everything at risk. Yeah, oh my gosh, it sounds horrible. But I mean, was that, I guess that's just the way that they did it. And I'm curious, between goat and, or like, you know, livestock impact and those other types of impact, more mechanical and chemical impacts, do one of them have, are goats as effective as the others?
I think everything needs to kind of be circulated as a tool, and like no one of those things is effective as another, like kind of combine them together. So like running a pecan head, running a brush cutter through, I mean, you're just mowing it basically. So if you go through a bunch of multiflora or honeysuckle that's 15 feet tall and you mow it off of the pecan head, the root structure is still there, so it shoots up everything in a fury. So it comes, it's like the hydra, you cut the head off, three more grow back. I mean, it comes back hard and strong. And if you spray it, one, you have you're impacting everything else around it. So if you blanket spray it, you're killing everything around, the good stuff, the bad stuff, everything. And fire is probably like one of the best things, but you can't always carry a fire through, especially a forest, the timber, the place where you have more of a problem with your woody brush. That's more of a grassland, prairie type of situation,
Just
and
not
it's
enough
effective
undergrowth
there.
fuel to kind of carry the fire through yourself.
Exactly. But if you can kind of combine them, I always talk about rotating through. Like if you're going to run the brush cutter through, then run the goats the next year, build up a fuel source, and then run a fire through once you have that fuel source. Because again, when you mow it and it all comes back, it's a little bit different than if you graze it. And they're defoliating, they're taking all the leaves off, and so then it won't grow back because it's had a longer impact, taking off all those leaves, so it can't photosynthesize. It sends up reserves from the roots into the leaves again. You nail it again and just kind of keep hitting it, and it's just a little simpler, a little more cost effective to run animals through than to run a $100,000 skid loader, track loader with a $35,000-$50,000 forestry head and bulletproof glass, and all, you know, you're running a tank with a cutter on it.
No, for sure. Yeah, it seems like a logical option, but it's probably not as 100% effective. Nothing really is. But so then the genetics, and the boar goats. I mean, that sounds like my first bull experience when I bought an animal that had pretty much been fed like a show steer, constant feed, to totally fell apart when he got home. I mean, was that system, did it even work at all, or was it a complete wreck when you tried to run him like you did?
I would say it didn't work at all. And that's why I didn't just go like, okay, here's some boars and crossbred boars. It's I had Spanish, I had Savannah, I had Miatonic, I had boars, I had all the different dairy. There's like 20 different kinds of dairy goats. I had every single species you could, or breeds that you could think of, to see how, which ones work for this or that. And like each one has their pros and cons, but like, think about like, and not just me taking them on jobs. I mean, I'm just talking like the farming side of things. Like if you've got them on your farm, you've got a bunch of cattle and you want to start clearing out brush in your own ground, you get some goats. Well, you're going to have multiflora rows that your dairy goats are going to be dragging a big old udder right through all that brush. So you're going to have cuts, scrapes, you're going to start shutting down that udder. Like all, you're going to have scar tissue, and dairy goats just won't work. Plus, I mean, they do produce animals, which has meat on them, but I mean, just like dairy cattle, like they're just not going to be as effective as a meat breed.
Yeah.
So then you get down to your Spanish, your Savannah, your boar, and your Kiko. Your boars, like we talked about, the show industry, they've pretty much the whole life been fed either in a bucket in a show ring or even on the commercial end. They're all in feedlots. Like nobody really raises goats out on pasture. You know, there's going to be a minute amount. Some people do, but high graining, and then you have like monthly deworming or quarterly deworming, too much deworming in general.
Yeah.
And then foot structures, like your hoof growth. You, with goats, you have to trim feet. Like cattle, you don't have to. Once in a while, you have to. With goats, you always have to. You might not have to. But so that, especially the boars. And then the Spanish are probably the best of those that I just mentioned, as far as they don't need quite as much maintenance, but they also don't put on a lot of meat. They, in my experience, they've been pretty skinny, had a lot of singles, which to me, you got to have twins to be paying the bills.
Yeah.
And they're just like Spanish goats are raised well, as far as like in the wild, pretty rough terrain, but they're not documented as well as the Kiko. Like Kikos have, high documentation, high, because the Spanish were just feral goats down in Texas, Mexico region, just down south. Then they were brought up different places. But the Kikos just been really focused in on. They have competitions around the country, buck tests, and you're really testing them for parasite resistance and growth and ribeye area and all these different factors that the boar, I mean, it's open to a lot of different, like any breed can get in it. Boars just don't do very well because they can't handle parasites. Savannas are just like a boar, maybe 10% better, but they're both from South Africa. They're both that dry, arid climate and pretty well a show type of body. Not really meant for the brush and surviving off of, you know, dump them off, leave them for a couple weeks and come back and check on them. Kikos are going to have a lot of them there. Like, especially you do that. There's been that experiment done. You take 100 boars, dump them off, come back a year later. There's like 7 boars left.
Oh, boy.
And, and then the Kikos, I mean, you dump off 100 and they're and a buck. You come back the next year, they've tripled in the number. You're going to lose a couple, obviously, but I mean, they're going to triple in number and then they're going to be breeding. You pick them all up. You got half. They're all bred again. They're ready for market. It's a perfect scenario.
Sure.
So they've done that in Hawaii. They've done that in just all kinds of places.
That's pretty cool. When you said at first you started with a Kiko buck, was there a reason you just sold everything and went all Kiko, or you saw the hybrid vigor? Was there, I mean, is there an advantage to doing the crossbreeding and just kind of keeping that line as opposed to going purebred Kiko, or?
Yeah. And I've done that. That kind of the crossbreeds that I was most comfortable with were a cross with Kiko in it already. And so like that, they weren't necessarily registered stock, but they had Kiko and you could tell there was Kiko, boar, Spanish, Savannah. There was all kinds of crossbreed in there. But my issue with that is, so the first year you're at 50%, the next generation you're at 75%. But if you're breeding that first year, you're breeding them at 7 months to kid at 12 months. So that's, you can do that. Like in cattle, you just don't do that. But in goats, sheep, a lot of people like it because you have a quicker income source, and you do. But if you wait the full year, like you do with cattle, you wait until they're a year and a half to breed them and then kid them out at 2 years old, you're going to have higher kidding rates. Less bottle kid issues, less birthing issues in general if you wait. So if you're doing that and you're starting with any other breed and cross into a Kiko, I mean, now it's 2 years before you have something, and then 4 years before you have 75%, 6 years you're at 88%. You're talking 10 years before you really have a full out Kiko.
And did you want full out Kiko, or is there advantage to having a crossbred? You get some of the benefits of both.
You can get some of the benefits of both, but I don't see a ton of benefit. Like to me, I want to avoid the maintenance issue. Like the Kikos have the body, they have the parasite resistance, they have the feet, they have the mothering, they're the total package.
Yeah.
I don't see a lot of benefit in the other breeds. The boars and Savannahs are going to be a little more bulky.
Yeah.
But that's about all they have. You have one positive and 4 negatives.
Sure.
Versus 5 positives and not really a negative.
So the Kikos do have adequate body muscling, you know, meat, like they're decent for meat production.
Yeah, we take them markedly at grade ones. Yeah.
Really? Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that makes sense then, I guess, if you don't want to, that's a good way to look at it.
Which not all Kikos are going to be the same either. I mean, there's, it's a feral breed. Like the breeders developed out of New Zealand with feral goats that were, you know, short legged. smaller bodied, but they were feral. They had that parasite resistance and that survivability. That's good mothering. They were bred up with dairy goats, so they got taller, but it takes years to really zero in on not just the parasite resistance and the good feet and the survivability and the mothering, but that body build up too. And there are a handful of breed. There's a number of breeders around the country that are doing that, but you have more, I'd say there's more people that are just raising them to raise them versus focusing in on having that nice square body, wide chest, good build, get the grade number one kids. Because to me, it's like, for us, we got there. I mean, we were having 200% kidding rate, which is what we want to see. And then it was getting hard to find something to cull for. We culled half the herd for 5 years and just to zero in on those best genetics. So we culled everything that didn't meet that high standard of you're kidding and raising two kids each. So once we got to that 200% kidding rate and weaning rate, then we start zeroing in on, okay, we need you to produce your weighting kids. So I like 80 to 120 pound doe. So 100 pounder raising two kids that weigh 50 pounds at weaning at 3 months old. So she's weaning off her body weight at weaning. And then in a year, she's got double her weight there on the ground. And so when you're trying to go after that and then start raising those kidding rates, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just trying to, I might have lost you a little bit. Walk through that again. Just, I was trying to follow and I got just a little.
I get on a roll sometimes.
No, this is the stuff I wanted to hear. And I noticed I kind of didn't follow. So I wanted to just clarify and make sure I did follow because it's interesting. So you were talking like kidding rates and weights and of everything.
Yeah. So I'll focus in on the kidding rates. So kidding rate, everyone wants twins. Twins is the goal for any goat producer. Yeah. But the nationwide average is like 1.35. Like it's not actually at that two that you have in your head that you think you can do that everyone wants when they get goats. And so we're just going to get basically cull everything that has a single and cull everything that can't at least raise her twins then. Sure. So, and that, then you're like, your byproduct is you're culling bad udders too, which you don't know that. You're just like, she's not raising her kid. And then you check her out. Yeah, it's because she has a bad udder. That's why her kid is a bottle kid.
Yeah.
But so we got to 200% and we were happy with that. We culled everything that had singles. And then the next year we culled everything that had singles. And the next year we could, just keep culling everything that doesn't raise twins. And we got to a comfortable 200% kidding it for a couple of years. And it's like, how do you improve on that? Like, we're content. Well, in farming, you should never be content. You're always working, always pushing towards the next thing. So we just culled everything on the lower end of that 200%. Like, okay, you raise 200% kidding rate, but you weigh 150 pounds and you raise two kids that weaned off at 45 pounds apiece. You should be weighing 90 pounds. So now we're going to cull that big doe because we don't need a 150 or 200 pound doe out there. We need 80 to 120 pounders that can raise those proper weaning rates.
Yeah.
And so when we're getting rid of those big bodies
question. Sorry. Yeah. When you talk kidding rates, is that's actual weaning weights? They're weaning 200%. Like, I mean, you might start kidding a little more and lose some over the year, or you're accomplishing a weaning weight of 200%.
Yeah, and sometimes we'll wean them a little earlier. So like sometimes our numbers will get off a little bit as far as like at 90 days is usually our hard. We sell them here. Well, if I have a mark, somebody comes to me and says, I want some 30, 40 pounders for whatever they're going to do, I'll sell them then. And then I'll just kind of mark them as it's sold. And so that's a null. So if you're that's rare, that's getting kind of picky on what I'm
sure.
I'm. But yeah, for the most part, you're kidding and weaning a rate of 200%. So then after we decided to focus in on that and call the bottom percentage of those 200%ers, we went up to 235. 2 years ago, we had 200%, followed by 235%, followed by 265%. And then last year, we actually had a 2.95 kidding rate across the board on our does, which means we had a lot of quads and quints and virtually no singles. And again, if you're single, then you get cold. So you get rid of those pretty quick.
Wow. So you're averaging well over 200% now.
Correct.
And do they have troubles? I mean, mothering ability, and do they have troubles when you start having triplets and twins and triplets, or are they pretty good at
taking care of? So it's kind of funny how like cattle have four teats and they have one calf, and goats, they have two teats, but they can raise three or four sometimes.
Yeah.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, they can have trouble, and that's where you just kind of watch them. Like, I'd say if I have a doe who has only ever had twins, or it's her first time kidding and she has quads, I'm not going to trust her to raise those quads. But then I'll look at her lineage and look at my, I've got an Excel sheet that takes 7 minutes to open with all this data tracking on it.
Okay. Yeah.
So when I open that up and I look back at, okay, you're out of this doe who has statistically done her job in raising triplets or quads or quints, then I'll give you a chance. But I typically like to see you raise a good set of twins that wean off proper before I will let you raise triplets or better. If you have triplets on the first go, I might just pull one to make sure that you're going to raise those twins. But again, it just depends on if I'm looking up your lineage and you can do it. Let's see.
Sure. Yeah. So, and you maybe said this already, but are you keeping everything over to actually kid at 2 years old? Is that what you're choosing to do?
Yeah. Well, and also like any farmer, like we got to experiment, try something new every year. So last year we actually bred at 12 months to kid in the fall. So trying our fall kidding at 18 months. So kind of splitting the difference there.
Yeah.
And it was actually our best record ever, as far as we had zero losses, zero bottle kids. So everyone took care of their kids. Perfect.
Wow.
But we did have a lot more singles because we bred early.
Sure.
So remember I said, if you're breeding at 12, kidding at 12 months, you're going to have a higher chance of singles, higher birthing rates, or higher birthing problems, all these different things.
Yeah.
Well, so we basically made it, we got rid of all of those issues, except for there was still singles at 18 months for fall kidding, but they raised them.
Yeah.
They kidded without having issues. Like that's, I would say that's still a pretty strong win. And now I've offset my kidding. We used to just kid in the spring. We did some winter actually for a while, but, we pretty much just kid in the spring, and now I can do spring fall with two different groups. We do not breed the same group multiple times in a year because that's just a lot of work on the doe. But now we do have two different groups that kid spring fall, but that's new. That's like we've done that 6 months ago.
Sure. Okay.
That's brand new feat that we're trying.
Yeah. Just because I'm curious on this, like how much issue comes with planning to kid at 12 months old? Because I don't know, as a cattle guy, the income's not as high, so maybe it's not as much of a concern to you, but to have an animal that doesn't produce income for a whole year is pretty, I don't enjoy that. So, I mean, if you can get a kid on year one and she's paying her own way as a one-year-old, that's nice to know. But if it comes with so much extra trouble that the money isn't worth the hassle, I guess, then, you know, I mean, can you expand a little more on that?
So you typically breed in the fall, breed her at 7 months, a 5 month gestation on goats. So at 12 months on her first birthday is when you're going to be having that kid if you're going that route, and she might be able to do it. But for me, I would rather wait until the second year because you have a higher chance of twins. So if you have a single and then it takes a lot out of her, she raises a single, maybe it's a little smaller. So I don't say a runt, but kind of, you know, if she raises a runt single and she struggles and she's stunted because of it and all the risks that go with that. And she doesn't have as much milk production. She might not have enough milk flow, causing some udder structure issues, versus if you wait until she's two and she has twins, then your udder is getting sucked from both sides. So you're having an even amount.
Sure.
Cause a lot of times that kid might just favor one side and never switch. You might have a higher chance of a blowout. But like I said, I did that for years, breeding them at a year. My experience has been wait until they're two. You're just a little easier. And if you have time, I mean, if you've got 10 or 20 goats, you can do that all day. But when I've got 500 goats out there, I don't want to be babying something because it's too young to be a mother. Just because she's old enough to have a kid doesn't mean she should.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of opinions on that, especially on the commercial side of things. Like commercial producers, if I can breed it, I want to breed it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's up to you. And people kind of learn from it. And I've got one guy I've been helping along. He's pretty close to me. He's been with me for 5 years. We've been working together. And this is the first year he finally said, you know what? I'm going to wait to breed him.
Yeah.
And he grains pretty heavy too. So I remember he pulled a kid that was over 20 pounds out of a doe. And I mean, the kid was dead. The mother had some issues. So he got her revived, fed her, and then took her to market. And he made good money for a cold doe. But I mean,
yeah,
that if you would have waited, you might have been better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to talk people out of it if they want to
No.
try it, because it's worth trying. Like, I have a 14-year-old doe in her who was bred at 7 months, kitted at 12 months. The longevity is there on her. She's not small. She's as big as anybody. And she had triplets most of her years.
Yeah.
But that might be an outlier.
Yeah. Well, it'd be cool if that becomes like the next step. Like you say, you first got to 200%, then you got to 265% with a better weights. And then the next thing is you start going to 12 months again and seeing the one, start culling the ones that do singles on 12 months. And I don't know. Yeah. Maybe there's a,
challenge accepted.
yes. Yeah. Let's see where you can go with this. But no, that makes a lot of sense. Did when you do the 12 months, do they typically, are they stunted in the way that they will continually do only singles, or will they oftentimes by the second time they're back in with everyone else catching twins and whatnot?
I would still probably give them a pass that second year, knowing that you could have a higher chance of that single. I mean, same thing. Like when I'm kidding them at 12 months or at 24 months, I still, like, if you have a single because it's your first kidding, like, I might still let that slide even though it's your first kidding. So if you're going with that, like, you might give too many passes if you keep trying to do the breed them from the beginning. But my general rule is first kidding, you get a pass on a single, but I have a lot more triplets that are raised well on that second year.
Okay.
So basically, you're almost guaranteed, if you wait to 2 years, you're almost guaranteed twins. You might have a single and you might have triplets versus that first year. You hope you get a single.
Yeah.
And if you have twins, I don't know if she's going to have enough milk to take care of them, but there's a lot of factors that go into that.
Yeah. I suppose if they have a high likelihood of having singles the first 2 years, you're better off just waiting till the second year and getting a double, because you get the same amount of kids.
And you don't have any labor involved.
Any of the issues. So let's talk about that part a little more. Like, talk about actually the logistics of getting out 500 plus goats. And what does that actually look like? How much work are you doing? I've heard of some people say, you know, just leave them be, almost like get out and let them do their thing, and you just make sure there's feed and whatever. And then some are a little more involved.
Yeah, so you definitely can. I'm a little more involved as far as record keeping than probably your average farmer, especially at that scale. Like, you typically, your smaller scale farmers have higher records and your larger scale farmers have larger numbers. And you don't have much in between. And I'm finding that threshold of where it's actually manageable to do that, because it's a lot right now. And
what
I've
got
help.
Are you keeping?
So for me, biggest thing is, so I got to think about it. So when they're born, I get out there. So I want to know exactly what kids are born to what doe. This doe number, 436, just kitted. She's got triplets. And so I'm going to ear tag them with, in a series. So if you're like this year, I'm doing 4,000 series. So 2024 starts with a four and four digits. So, I mean, so 4001, 2, and 3 are out of this doe. And so I know the order that they're born. I know what kids go with what doe. I mean, that's pretty standard, right?
Yeah.
But so that means I'm out there every day throughout kidding. And there will be a day this year where I have 100 kids on the ground.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And so I'll be out there taking the documentation of what mother had what kids, what was the birth weight, what was the birth rate, and then obviously checking genders too. And and now I'm actually I'll be castrating some of those right off the bat too. That's another, I'm involved with Practical Farmers of Iowa, and we do research studies on all kinds of stuff. Last year we did one on weaning or castration banding at birth, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and how does that affect growth rates? Because there's always the talk about testosterone as a natural growth hormone, but then the goats will go into rut. So, like, what actually works? So I do studies through them, through other places. Like, I'm a farm nerd, so, like, I want to know answers.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of stats that I keep track of for myself, but also for other places, other people, universities. And I want to know how to. You can't get to perfection, but I want to try.
No, totally. Okay, that makes sense. We do a lot of the same stuff with registered cattle, and I would love the idea of being a commercial producer of something to not have to do that. Sounds so nice.
I know.
I hate
record
piece of it, but
That's exactly how it is. Because I mean, we raise registered stock too, and it's like, it'd be so nice to just let them all kid out on their own and just watch it and enjoy it. But I gotta know how you're doing, because if you're not, and that's where you talk the difference between Spanish and Kiko. A lot, like, you're down in Texas and you've got 10,000 acres and 2,000 goats, they kid, you go pick up your kid crop, your does But you don't know if those does are all raising twins or singles, or if those does have even produced in the last 7 years. And I can't stand something to be not working either.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. No, cool. Sorry. So then anyway, getting back into the logistics of kidding, what that looks like and yeah, how much work. It sounds like it's pretty low input, which is nice. Before we dive into the logistics of kidding with Adam, I want to tell you a little bit about my sponsor, Barn to Door. Barn to Door is a solution built for farmers to help manage all of your direct sales, both online and in person. My wife and I have been using them now for over 3 years to help us manage our grass-fed cattle company business. And with Barn to Door, we've been able to build consistent recurring cash flow with subscriptions to our farm products. But most importantly, Barn to Door has helped us save time by simplifying order management. And if you're looking to get back time with your family while operating a successful direct-to-consumer farm business, I'd encourage you to check out Barn to Door. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn more about how we've utilized them. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session. That's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, and that link will be in the show notes. But now we'll dive back into Adam's experience kidding at his farm.
Yeah, so I mean, all I'm doing is going out there, I'm tagging kids, I'm keeping track. So I've got a notebook with everything on it, tagging, weighing, writing all that down. But I mean, one of those, like it's constant motion, and I don't get them all at the same place. I've got multiple places because I don't want to have too many does and too many kids. I've had them kid on a pile of 15 kids before, and I got to figure out what mom had these.
Yeah.
And I can mitigate that by having multiple places to kid out. And then it's not just me. I've got help. I've got family that helps out. My dad's a huge part. My sister and brother-in-law, they kid a bunch out at their place. I'm still going there every day, but it's just, they're there. If there's an emergency, they've got four kids and they're out running around checking goats and doing their thing.
Yeah.
They're all under eight. So, I mean, they're not doing a ton, but they're there. Mm-hmm. And then bottle kids, I've got local 4-H kids that we help out and they help us out. And I've got a high school kid that comes out and does a little work and just, yeah, it's a big task during kidding season, but it's,
yeah,
I don't know. It's fun. It's my favorite time of year. Yeah. Most stressful time of year, but still my favorite time of year.
If you were a commercial guy, not needing all of that records and stuff, I mean, do you think it would be pretty hands-off low input kidding thing, or will you always have, you know, does fighting over kids and issues with bottle lambs or bottle kids that you need?
And that's where a lot of my customer base is, that they're commercial producers who want something that the work has already been done because they've had bad experience of, they bought a bunch of goats from somewhere and they all sucked. And so they'll come pick up what I've got that I've already put a bunch of time and records and inputs into. And so then they will take that, they'll kit it out and come back, usually come back the next year for, they might buy 20 head, they'll come back the next year and buy another 20 head because the kid crop paid for the does. And to me, that's the goal, is you want those kids to wean off, go across the scale, paying for your breeding stock and in every year's income after that. It's a very profitable business if you've got good stock. Yeah. It's a very cost negative business if you've got poor quality stock.
Well, you're speaking my language. I mean, this is exactly what we do. I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast or with Faro Cattle Company and what we're doing. I mean, we're doing the same stuff with cattle, of trying to just produce low input cattle to reduce necessary inputs, overhead, equipment, infrastructure, all the things that cost money and suck the profit out of a cattle business. And it sounds like you're trying to do the same thing, make hands-off goat production, you know, kind of, you know, possible, which sounds like otherwise it may not be.
Sure. And I mean, I'll tell you why goats instead of cattle in the first place. I mean, I wanted to get into cattle and there was brushy ground that I wanted to clean up. And once I'll get some goats, clear this out the natural way, turn a little profit on those meat kids, and then get cattle. Well, start looking at all of the inputs that you would be putting in as far as like your fencing, your biggest thing is your corral. I mean, your corral to load them into a trailer, you need a pretty sturdy corral for cattle. You need heavy duty equipment, big trailers, big trucks, all that stuff. Unless you're customing it out, that's fine. But like, if you're trying to do it all yourself, you need a lot heavier equipment, and it's a little more dangerous as far as trying to move a 1,200 pound cow versus a 100 pound doe. I mean, I can pick her up, I can put her in the back of a stock rack, and take her. I have like a dozen big dog kennel cages that'll hold pretty much any goat in my operation. And so I've had people show up, or they'll come with a dog cage and a Subaru. I have almost more Subarus come to pick up goats than then big stock trailers. Had a guy from North Dakota come down with a 24-foot gooseneck with a Dooley. He drove all the way down to pick up a buck. And then I said that to him. And the next year, he bought a Prius specifically. He just drove down and threw the goat in the back. And he's like, I saved enough money in not having to drive my truck and trailer all the way down here to justify this.
That's awesome. That's funny. Yeah. No,
he comes down every year, buys a new buck every single year, and he's happy, happy guy.
I bet. That's awesome. Huh. Okay. So we've kind of talked about a lot of the numbers that go into the finances of this business, but maybe let's look at them more from a specific kind of profitability, if that's something you're okay talking about. I mean, all the expenses that go into it, the production and average price on an average year, not a good year, but like what that might look like, if that's something you're comfortable walking through.
Yeah, I got a calculator and a notepad in case I get
perfect
confused.
Okay, well, let's start with, I guess, costs. What are all the costs? And I know you do like grazing for hire, so a lot of times you're not on your own land, but can you talk, I don't know if you know the data, like how many you would stock and pasture rates and stuff if it was on your own ground or something?
So, I mean, for the most part, we just kind of ignore the fact that I do the custom grazing because people who are looking to get into that, I say, don't get into it unless you have enough land to sustain what you've got going on, because you cannot control those jobs. Like, you have contracts and whatnot, but like they cancel all the time. Sure. So you have to have enough land to sustain yourself. So with those numbers, I usually recommend people do one goat per acre to start with, one doe. So that doe could have two or three or more kids. So when you have one goat per acre, say you've got 100 acres and 100 goats, you now might have 300 kids. So now you have 400 goats per 100 acre. Yeah. So four goats per acre.
Is that open grassland you're talking about, or?
It's kind of anything. So like there's more forage for goats in timber than there is on grass in the beginning. But if you graze it so hard, knock out all of that brush, which you'll do pretty quickly, which is why this is brush management business. But if you're on your own ground, you kind of want to manage it and not knock it all out if you're trying to raise your goats there. So the first few years I was doing this, I knocked out all the brush on this farm. And now that farm isn't as valuable to me anymore for raising goats. So I actually picked up other farms and other rental farms that I can operate on. And those I manage a little better, depending how you look at it, as a farmer or as a custom grazer. But so one goat per acre. And the fun thing with that is you can also just add those two. So if you've got 100 cattle on 100 acres, you can add 100 goats and you won't really see an effect because they eat different things.
Sure.
And so anyway, so one goat per acre raising 2 to 3 kids, let's just say two. Yeah. So two goats you wean them off at 3 months, which is the normal time to wean them off. You can then take those to market. You should be getting about $150 a piece, about $3 a pound for kid goats. So 50 pounds, $150. Depending on your market, you might get up to 200.
Sure.
Or you keep them on mom, or you either wean them off and graze them separately, or keep them on mom for another 2 or 3 months. So 5 to 6 months of age, you're at 80 to 100 pounds. You should be at $200 to $300 a piece for them. If you keep them for an entire year, I look at the annual salary, the annual income of an animal. So the day it's born, if I can keep it for a year, so then I'm selling them in the spring, which happens to be hitting that Easter market as well. So now we're talking $300 a piece. So that doe who raised two kids at $300 a piece is raising $600. So you should be making about $600 an acre if you're raising one doe per acre. When you figure out what you're doing, I don't recommend doing this from the get-go, but once you figure out how to properly manage them and rotate them, you can raise well more than one goat per acre. But even if you just increase that to two, you're talking $1,200 an acre. Mm-hmm. You're talking corn price now.
Okay. And so I guess, is that the common way, or do you think most people sell weaned goats? Is there a logistical simplicity to just getting rid of them?
There is very much a logistical simplicity to doing it. And I contemplate that every year of like, should we just get rid of everything at that time?
Yeah.
But for the most part, I'm a smart farmer with this. Like, I try to spread out my keep my eggs in different baskets. So I sell a portion of them before they even wean. I sell a portion at weaning.
Sure.
I keep a portion on the moms because I keep my doughlings on mom until they are 5 months old. Because if you get all the boys off, now
Okay.
mother has time to focus and teach her daughter, teach her doling what to do, what to graze,
Yeah.
how to be a goat. Like they learn so much. And some people kind of laugh at that, like, oh, just put them on grain. They get nutrition that way. I mean, sure, they might get some plenty of nutrition, but they need to learn. For me, breeding stock need to learn how to be breeding stock from good breeding stock.
Yeah.
So when you're learning from mom and you're getting more milk, your brother was getting half the milk. Now you're getting all the milk and you're
Sure.
helping her slowly wean. If you wean everybody
Uh-huh.
at 3 months, it's kind of hard on that doe to just go cold turkey. You're in highest milk pool possible and then cold turkey, which if
Yeah.
she has two boys, they might be doing that, which is why sometimes I will keep one boy, like castrate him and leave him on mom, kind of acting as a doling. So then
Sure.
I'll have some of those wethers are with the doe herd still. So then when I wean dolings, I also wean some of those wethers off, take those to market. So there's my third step of third timing of income. And then other wethers that I have grazing on these pastures without mother's milk, just grazing on pastures, there'll be a fourth step of income at 5 or 6 months, and then I'll keep another portion until that 1 year mark. You just
Yeah.
is it worth feeding them hay? And like you're saying, is it you might as well get rid of my weaning? Sure, but
Yeah.
also if I've got them on stockpiled forage, or if I'm bale grazing, I bale graze, I roll out more hay than the does need. So if I have a handful more goats in there, they can eat that, and then they'll just be more income later in the year.
Sure.
Hopefully at a higher rate. I mean, if there comes in and the timing of the market's right, then you should have steady income, steadily increasing income per animal.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we'll just say as if we're weaning them all at 3 months and selling them so that you don't have anything through the winter. You've got weaned dry does at that point. How much hay are they consuming? What's the quality and expense of the hay? I mean, are they pretty picky stuff, or can they eat pretty poor hay as well?
So typically a goat will eat 5 to 8% of body weight. I just say 5 to 10. So a
Okay.
100 pound doe is going to eat 5 pounds of hay per day.
They're
And
100 pound
that's
does, is that what?
yeah, roughly 100 pounders. So 80
Okay.
to 120 pounds. So 100 pound average. So you're eating 5 pounds of hay a day. So if I'm feeding a higher quality hay, like alfalfa, clover, grass mix, something nice,
Yeah.
I'll go with a 5 pound 5 pound per day ratio. But this, so you know, we've been in a 3 year drought here in Iowa, in our part of Iowa. This is coming up on our 4th year that we're prepared for another drought.
Sure.
So we could bale a lot of CRP grass this past year. So that is a much lower quality hay because it's cut super late and it's stemmy. So that I'll increase to that 10 pounds per day. So I'll roll out plenty of hay for that. And that I would say you have to roll out. You can't
Yeah.
really feed that in one of our collapsible goat hay feeders. And we can get those produced a lot cheaper too. Just it's CRP hay. So it's going to
Yeah.
be cheaper to buy that or to make that than to buy higher quality hay.
Sure. Okay. So I think if I just did $150 a ton hay, which is maybe what you can find on average, I mean,
Sure.
and stuff at 8 pounds per day on average throughout the winter.
Yep.
60 cents per day, or times 180 days. If you fed them all 6 months of winter, that's $108 per doe per year, or call it $100 round numbers. If you should be able to maybe graze longer than 6 months or something, you'd say that's pretty fair. $100 per doe to feed for a year.
Yeah, that'd be pretty fair. I mean,
Okay.
we're stacking enterprise and stacking things on
Yeah.
top of that as far as we're grazing corn stalks,
Sure.
we're putting
Yeah.
cover crops down, we're doing
Yep.
all kinds of stuff, like especially last year, just because our rotation this year, we have beans, but like last year it was corn with cover crops. They grazed until late January and then they
Yeah.
started eating again in early March. So we basically had to feed them hay for like a month and a half.
Perfect. Yeah.
This year we fed a little more hay, but it was because we had all that CRP hay. We rolled
Sure.
out way more than we needed, but I also trying to increase my seed bank and my soil quality on my hilltops and
Yeah.
certain areas. I'm trying to reseed through that,
Sure. Yeah.
but that's kind of against the point of what
No.
you're.
Well, that's a huge, because if $100 is the worst case scenario, like that's if you got a
Exactly.
November 1st you start feeding until May 1st. And that's, you know, that's probably hopefully worst case scenario, but if you can start saving even more and grazing longer, then this only gets better. So that's good to know. But worst case scenario, you're $100 in feed. What other costs are there associated with cash costs, I guess, so that non-labor and land, I guess.
And as far as that, like your hay, like you're talking $150 a ton hay, which is, I think, is a good estimate, especially for listeners. That's what if you're going to go buy your hay. But I mean, if we're getting it, I typically like when it's made, I like to go pick it up from the farmer. So I'm getting it for half that if it's made at the time. They don't have to touch it. They just make the bale, we'll go pick it up. And then even more so with, you know, if you're baling, if you're making it yourself, we can make it for between $26 and $34 a bale, depending on where. But I mean, it's, yeah, you can make it a heck of a lot cheaper, but like you said, high rate of 108 bucks.
That's what it's worth if you sold it. So you probably sell it to your own
That's,
goats
yeah,
at that.
I've heard you talk about that before, so that's a good point.
Yeah, funny. I maybe said that before, I guess. No. Okay, good. So were there any other cash costs, non-overheads, labor, land, equipment that are associated with them?
So I would say mineral is going to be up there a little bit. I mean, not that they eat a lot, but I would say you should be giving them mineral, salt and mineral. They don't eat very much, but get on a good mineral program. High copper is highly recommended. Your sheep, of course, your sheep can't handle copper, but goats almost, they'll take what the sheep are missing. Like they need more copper than a cattle, and the sheep need less. So I mean, it's a lot of people, like they'll lump sheep and goats together. To me, they're so different. I don't know anything about sheep. And I can tell you a lot about goats. But that high copper is important. And so mineral and hay with us rotating around. I mean, we're gonna have water hauling for the last couple of years with drought. We're hauling more water than before. Initially, I set up all of these farming, all these spots for, I want all of my paddocks to have water flowing through them, whether it's a pond or a stream or ephemeral stream, something that's just there when it rains or just there in the spring. I rotate strategically for that reason. But now we've just basically accepted, like, there's no water anymore. So we just have to haul it. So there's going to be a little higher cost with your fuel, your time, and your water hauling. But that's, somebody might have a better scenario than that. So it might have automatic waters here and there. But no, as far as like, because we don't do any grain, I can't say we're 100% grain free because we do graze corn stalks and cover crops. So they're probably going to pick up a couple pieces of corn that way, but we don't feed them grain. And then otherwise, equipment wise, I mean, you're going to need something that can pick up a bale, whether it's a skid loader or a tractor. I actually got a bale bed this year, so I can do
Nice.
that a little simpler.
Yeah.
Used for really, like, you should. That's expensive. Like, no, I got it for nothing because it's an old beater. But equipment wise, I mean, I started this. Yeah, I started out with a 95 Dodge with 250,000 miles and a 1980s Kiefer built trailer, 16-foot bumper pull. And those two
Nice.
things together, I mean, might combine for a total of $3,000 in equipment cost.
So you can be pretty
And
low overhead.
yeah, and I got them for less than that. Like they put a new floor and put new tires on the trailer, but I mean, otherwise it's just a shell that you can pull behind a trailer, a truck, and then the electric net fencing that you can get from Premier One for $100 a roll or $200 a roll. And yeah, it can be pretty cheap to get started. So as far as overhead cost, you know, $5,000 with animals included.
$5,000 with animals included.
Depending on, yeah.
What you're getting, how many, whatnot. But okay, so that's
Depending on where what you're doing, and yeah.
So I want to ask about the fencing. Don't let me forget to ask you about fencing. You just mentioned the Premier One, but so we're in, I don't know what the mineral costs, but just over $100 an animal in co cash costs, maybe 110, 120 bucks, something like that, and cash cost per year, and you got $300 roughly in revenue. So that leaves you, to $180 roughly in revenue per animal to cover your overheads. And one goat per acre, that's not really affecting production of anything else. I mean, that's and if it's in woods, the ground is almost considered free anyway. And that sounds like that's maybe the
Yeah,
ideal place. And you think,
no value for it. Yeah.
So yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm trying to think if we just running this through in my head of our own, we've got access to probably around 150 acres of woods that we could probably run. And if we did 150 times $180, that's $27,000 we could run on those woods and an additional gross margin to help cover our overheads that really wouldn't add much for other than labor, I guess. Labor and the fencing. And that was kind of the question I had too, is what is the hassle and headaches of fencing these animals? It sounds like you've not trained them to one wire poly wire or anything yet, so.
No, I like them to stay in.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, you can do it with less, but you got to be on top of it, and you got to be home all the time to make sure in case you get a call that they're out. And I like to also live my life and be able to go, I don't know, out of town for the day.
Yeah.
So yeah, I use electric nets, which some people hate, some people love. You got to learn to love it.
Yeah.
And I have very much learned to love it. It's so I use a 9-strand. It's technically a sheep fence because goat fence is a little taller. My goats don't jump, so I don't need tall
Okay.
fence. I just
Sure.
need it to be, I just need it to, like, I could probably keep in does with 3 strands, but I want to keep the kids in year round, and I don't want to have different. I like to have a standard. This is what we use all the
Yeah.
time
Sure.
instead of, just keeping does in with cheaper stuff.
Yeah.
And so 9-strand poly net, and then for my hard fences I use a product called, it's Stay Tough. It's out of Texas. It's 13 48 12, so 13 strands, 48 inches tall, 12 inch verticals. That's the key. So woven wire with 12 inch verticals, so the goats can put their head through the fence and
Yeah.
they can eat down your mulberries and your cedar trees and all that stuff, and pull their head back through without getting hung up. So with
Yeah.
your standard woven wire with a 6-inch hole, they're going to put their head through their hole, and they're going to be strangling themselves until you get there to pull them out.
Yeah.
So I try to get the point across to everyone. If you're going to put up 5-strand barbed wire for cattle, for the same money, you can put up this woven wire, and you could maybe someday have something besides cattle thrown in with your cattle. I mean, whether it's sheep or goats or anything, pigs, chicken, whatever, just anything else. This stuff is great as far as just it'll keep everything in.
Yeah.
And it won't get your head stuck. Like, they have a 4x4 goat and sheep fence, but it's more expensive, and it's like little kids can still get their head stuck in it.
Sure.
Because this stuff being a 12 inch vertical stay, it's cheaper to produce, it's lighter weight. I have 660 foot rolls that weigh less than your standard 330 foot roll and half the weight of your 4x4 330 foot roll.
Yeah.
So it's really effective.
If you've got already like four wire electric fence, is it like for a perimeter? Is it possible to just throw a couple more wires on? And would you trust that for goats, or would you just do everything completely surround them with the
I
electronet?
wouldn't. I wouldn't, for the simple fact of, if I say I would try it, then somebody tries it, they get goats, the goats get out, they cuss it, they
Yeah.
hate it, and they never get goats again. That's the biggest problem I found with goats, is anyone who has had goats and had a bad experience, they tell everyone else about their bad experience and talk everyone out of getting them, versus having do the research beforehand, talk to somebody who knows how to do it, learn from them, adapt to that, and do it right from the start instead of just trying to do it in on the cheap. Do it right and then make some money with it and be a profitable multi-tiered stacking enterprise operation.
Oh, that makes sense. And how does the Premier Net work through woods and brush?
Oh, it's that's where we run it all the time. Like, I
Yeah.
started the operation with 100% electric net. It was probably 5 years before I bought any permanent wire, because I didn't know how this was gonna go.
Yeah, fair. Sure.
I mean, like I said, that old truck and that old trailer and 10 rolls of net and 20 goats was like, I was happy with that, and it worked. And then after a few years, and I'm up to 100 goats, and it's like, okay, maybe I could start putting some permanent wiring, because once you lay the net out once, twice, three times, time and labor and equipment costs, you could have just put in a hard fence there. So I
Yeah.
kind of do that. And like, I love the electric net because I can divide my paddocks any which way I want. But after you do the same line for 5 years in a row or rotations in a row, you're like, yep, I'm going to build a hard fence there next
Yeah,
year. But
sure. Makes sense.
yeah, no, it goes through really well. If you just got to learn how to do it right. And I think I have a YouTube video out there somewhere I did for somebody. I think it was probably PFI. If you
Sure.
Google either Adam Ledvina, Iowa Kiva Goats, fencing or PF Practical Farmers of Iowa, something I'm sure that'll pop up. I go over some of the ways that we use that electric net fence, maybe different than what is recommended, but effective. But just, you know, laying it out and then going back and stepping it in.
Sure.
Sorry, not stepping it. We don't do the step in post. We do the regular, just single spikes, because they have two spikes and single spike. Spike, I think once you hit a rock, it gets bent and then it's a pain. Yeah. So you end up grinding those tips off anyway. So you might as well start single spike.
Makes sense.
But yeah, laying that out, then sticking it in the ground, and then getting your next roll and just go slow and steady until you learn how to do it right. I invested in a walk behind brush mower. Well, I did it different ways. I started with a chest harness brush cutter because I used to run that for the DNR.
Yeah.
And that is cheap and affordable, or it's not cheap, it's like $600 or more. But strap one of those on, it's pretty labor intensive, you're only taking 6 inches at a time. So then I over upgraded to a skid loader and a brush mower to mow a path, which kind of goes against everything that I got into the goats in the first place, that I don't have to buy heavy equipment.
Yeah.
So then I downgraded to a walk behind brush mower. It's a DR brush mower, I think like a 36 inch cut. And that thing will go anywhere. I mean, it's differential lock. You just pull the trigger and you go. You're push mowing through brush. It's great. And then you mow that path around where you're going to go, lay out that electric net, go back, put all the posts in the ground, and then turn your goats in. It's super, super smooth if you got the right tools and the right idea behind what you're doing. Two people is great because you can have one person lay out while the other person steps in.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of it by myself for a long time. So you just be ready to walk. Like, you stay in really good. You don't need to have a gym membership when you play with electric net.
Well, that's one thing I've noticed about, looking at you on Zoom and Jordan Meyer, who does this down in his woods too. I'm like, yeah, you guys are all in better shape than I am, probably. Cause I get spoiled with my cattle. I just roll out a poly wire and half the time I hook it to the back of my four wheeler and I drive and I just step in a post. I'm pretty spoiled, but no, that makes sense. And yeah, I'm just thinking, like, in our area where the woods are, they're on some pretty steep slopes. Usually what's flat-ish or even close is pasture or is tillable ground, and the stuff that's too steep to farm is wooded, and so it'd be pretty steep, probably rocky, rough ground, and that walk behind brush mower will go right up and down some of those hills.
Oh yeah, nope, it works great. I mean, if it's, I'd say the worst part is I get like a wetland you're trying to drive through, but it works. Like, it'll drive through a wetland.
Wow.
So I mean, it's pretty effective all around.
Yeah.
I'm happy with it. I'm not like, it happens to be a DR trimmer. I'm just saying what I've got. I'm not like sponsoring them, but I mean, I would be open to other brands that make it, but I'm happy with the one that I've got through them. Yeah. And I know BCS, like a lot of producers have like a BCS tractor. If they've got like a big garden, I've been around a lot of farmers who have a BCS tractor, and you just get the mower attachment and you're good to go with that too.
Cool.
So any walk behind brush mower is good.
Yeah. Awesome. No, that's awesome. And this is, it sounds pretty reasonable. Definitely got a lot of profit potential in it and stuff, especially if you're at a relatively small scale. I mean, as far as scaling it, if a person has a few hundred acres with a little bit of woods and a lot of pasture or something, are they really bred to thrive in woodlands, or are you wasting your time on putting them on grass? Or are you better off running sheep or something different? Or what are your thoughts with that?
I would. So they do the best on woody brush, but like I said before, like, we run out of woody brush on where we initially had them.
Yeah.
So they end up going to the grass, but that's what I always end up talking about that. Like, when you have if you're going to seed something down, or it's just pasture talk in general, like, I just avoid using spray on anything. Because if you're trying to spray your woody brush, like, get goats, and then you don't ever have to spray it. And, you know, having multiple, like, a diverse mix of different plants to eat. I mean, if you got cattle and goats, basically cattle and goats together equals a sheep. So you might as well have a double crop of cattle and goats and have all of those different species in the pasture, because you won't have those random bushes and brush growing in different places when you're combining the cattle and the goats. I don't know if you should be putting your cattle in the timbers, that's too steep and causing erosion and whatnot, but just, you know, rotate your goats through your woodland, and then also rotate them through your pasture with or behind or in front of your cattle, and just kind of keep rotating the goats everywhere and the cattle a little more contained in certain areas.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Cool. Well, we're already over an hour here and we haven't even gotten into your goat grazing for hire business. Is that something you want to just highlight real quickly? And I don't know, it's probably something that could have a whole conversation on, so maybe it's not worth talking about today.
Like what about it? Because yeah, it is like a whole nother rabbit hole, like to
yeah,
go
I
down.
mean,
But
well, yeah, because my questions are like, how do you find the customers? What are the logistics of like getting them and moving them around? Do you have a home base so you can bring them back to? But that's all like, if your jobs don't line up, that's all probably stuff we should talk about another time. So I guess I'll ask this then, on what we have talked about, more of the production, commercial production of goats. Is there anything that I've missed that you think would be important for someone to think about if they're wanting to go down that route?
I'm pretty much in the realm of no grain, no maintenance, all that. I mean, there's the in-between producer too, that, I mean, you can grain them, you can do all that, and you're just going to do basically what I've done to make this happen for me. You're just going to add more pounds by throwing that grain on top of them. I don't like to produce something that has been had a bunch of grain and then melts when you try to raise it like I raise it. I just try to make that good foundation of, this
yeah,
works with nothing, and then you can always improve it or, you know, make it bigger with that grain. But I don't know. I'm pretty happy with raising them how we raise them, with the low maintenance and high records, high statistics. Yeah. But
no, I like that model too. It's all what I try to do with cattle. So I like it. Makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate you coming on. Two questions I always like to ask people before I let you go here again. First of all, are there resources that you would recommend people check out if they want to do what you're doing? That can be books, conferences, you know, podcasts, whatever, any resources that you think people should check out.
I'm a fan of the Stock and Grass Farmer as far as like with books. I mean, a lot of books are great, but I've read so many goat books that are outdated. I mean, just
Sure.
goat books that are 5 or 10 years old seem to be like the wrong information than what I am doing. And a lot of them are for like goats in general. You have a lot of that, like
Yeah.
backyard goats and
Sure.
show goats and that kind of stuff. But, and as far as the conferences, I mean, PFI, Practical Farms of Iowa, I've been going to that for years. I'm pretty well with them on a lot. Like, they just have all kinds of anything, any type of farming you're looking to get into. They've got some people that have dealt with it in the conference. You meet all kinds of people. You're guaranteed to meet somebody who's doing something similar and talk over some good ideas.
Sure. Cool. No, that's perfect. And then lastly, how can people find you, reach out if they want to find more information, anything like that?
Yep. We used to have a website, but for the most part, we've got a Iowa Kicker Goats Facebook page. We do have an Instagram page as well, but I've been doing a lot more on the Facebook page for a lot more years. And we ended up dropping our website because we had way more traffic through our Facebook page. So that's
Sure.
probably the best way. And I'm sure there's email and phone number on there as well.
Cool.
Call me, reach out to me anytime. But we try to post something on there pretty close to every day, whether it's pictures or videos or some type of information and studies that we've been doing to improve the breed and the goats in general.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Adam. I really appreciate it. This was super interesting. It's my problem whenever I have like shiny object syndrome. Whenever I start talking about something like this, I'm like, oh boy, I got to buy some goats. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I could go for another 2 hours talking about
Yeah.
different things on them and
No, that's awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.